Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Hello, hello, everyone, and hello to you, Father.
Hello, Omri.
That was a strange greeting.
Well, I thought I'd change it for a bit.
Are you in a strange mood?
Maybe I am. Maybe I'm not. Maybe I... No, now I have to be in a...
You have to be serious. I have to be serious. This is a serious thing.
Okay, I mean...
You're dealing with something serious here.
Okay.
Anyway... Thank you for listening, as always. If you want to support the show, you can always recommend it to a friend or leave us a review. They are most appreciated. Welcome to Spies and Lies, an espionage podcast, co-hosted by me, Omri Rose, who spent his childhood living undercover, thanks to his dear old dad and co-host, Jason, a retired former spy master from one of the top intelligence agencies in the world. Without further ado, let's dive into today's episode. The Spy You Never Saw, Melita Norwood. Do you like the title?
It sounds interesting.
Sounds good, right?
Yeah.
Did you see her?
No, I didn't see her.
Oh, okay.
September 1999, sitting around a table inside a former NATO listening station in Teufelsberg, near Berlin, retired intelligence operatives from across agencies raise their glasses in a toast.
To absent friends fallen in the line of duty, and to fellow comrades in arms of the spy game, past, present, and future.
And for their last toast,
the Cold War Club welcomes a new member, Melita Norwood, who for 40 years of active duty evaded capture and exposure.
Meanwhile, in Bexley Heath, England, 87-year-old Melita Norwood calmly served tea to her guest, as through the drapes of her window and just outside beyond her front porch, there was a flurry of activity of journalists clamoring for a picture and an interview of the now famous Granny Spy. The first thing I want to say about the quote-unquote Granny Spy is I think it's such a silly thing to call her the Granny Spy.
It's what happens. Spies get old.
Yes, but for instance, you today, you're not the grandpa spy. You know, you did your espionage career as a young man and a middle-aged man. And an old man to some. But look, it's just a strange thing that they dubbed her the granny spy. I mean, they're painting this picture of like a granny doing espionage, but that's not really the case.
No, it isn't. But it's a nice story. Why did you do the Russian accent in the beginning?
Well, it's, you know, former intelligence people.
And do you think the Russians would be sitting around that table?
Maybe it was a defector.
Aha. Now, that adds a little bit of spice into the story.
Yeah, you know. Maybe,
you never know.
Exactly. Maybe it was Gordievsky sitting around the table there.
Let's see where this story brings us.
It could have been.
Yeah. It could have been.
It could have been. So, as we often do, we start in the beginning with Melita Sirnis. That's right, not Norwood yet. She was born in 1917 in Bournemouth, England. She was the daughter of a British mother and a Latvian father. Her father was a close associate of the Bolsheviks, the far-left party and a political organization in Russia, who were forced to leave, ending up in England. Melita's father became the estate manager for Tolstoy's overseas literary executor, Vladimir Chertkov, but died of tuberculosis in 1918 when Melita was six. I mention the literary circle and all this kind of stuff because it just kind of paints the background already of where Melita was growing up and what she was growing up around.
Correct. It's very important to understand it.
Yeah. I mean, the environment that she grew up in and the influences that she was already getting as a young girl definitely played into an effect. Norwood's mother was an English suffragette. That was the movement for women's rights to vote back in the UK. And she was also a Cooperative Party member, which was a center-left political party in the UK established in 1917, supporting cooperative values and principles. Melita's father, in addition to his work with Tolstoy, also produced a newspaper called The Southern Worker, a labor and socialist journal. It was strongly inspired by the 1917 October Russian Revolution, and the paper also published translated works by Lenin and Trotsky. In addition, he was involved in what was known as the Tuckton House, which was basically a group of Russian expats publishing translated editions of Tolstoy's works and diaries. So, already from an intelligence point of view, if at that time, which it wasn't at that time, people were concerned about these kind of things, it would be very easy to identify this group, right?
Yes, but we have to remember that Russia at that time was not an enemy.
That's why I specified that yes. At that time it was not an issue, it was not on anyone's radars.
England always welcomed exiled people and politicians and people, even today, from all around the world who are persecuted by their countries, and they allow them in.
They don't have good extradition laws, huh?
Well, among other things. And they prefer to live in England. And it was very common to have all sorts of people from all parts of the world who wanted to run away from the regime they were in to land in England. And communism and Russia and communism was a very popular thing in England. A lot of people leaned towards it.
Yeah, well, we have to remember, as always, the context and the time period.
Right.
This is pre-Soviet Russia, right?
Correct.
It's when these ideas are now spreading across the world. So these ideas are very appealing, you know,
yes.
the sense of distribution of wealth and equality among people. They're very beautiful, idealistic, utopian ideas.
Communist parties were everywhere in all the Western countries as well. It wasn't a negative thing so much.
Right. Well, because there was also no examples of it always failing, which unfortunately, due to human nature,
yes.
it does, as we've seen throughout history up until this point.
And the ideal of communism appealed for a lot of the youngsters of...
Definitely.
Of the new way of the world to be evolved.
Especially in a place like the UK, which had a rigid class system.
Yes.
Anyway, 1923, Melita won a scholarship to the Itchen Secondary School in Southampton. She became a school captain in 1928, studied Latin and logic at University College of Southampton, before dropping out in 1931. She grew to dislike the courses that her mother was suggesting for her, and instead decided to learn to ride a motorcycle and move to Paris. Much to her mother's dismay. We're seeing a bit of a rebellious streak.
Yeah, we see Paris. There's always people who go to Paris for some reason.
Well, again, it's the time period. Yeah, that was the popular destination in the 30s.
Now, are you planning to go to Paris?
No, thank you.
Good, okay. No, I just wanted to check if you...
but we do also see, you know, she was smart, she was bright, she did well at school, but she had that rebellious streak, adventurous streak as well.
Yes.
All traits that are important, as we will come to see later in her life.
Yes.
In spring of 1931, Melita's mother brought Melita and her younger sister to live in Heidelberg, Germany. She hoped that Melita would resume her studies. Instead, Melita found a new passion, field hockey. Melita and her sister joining the university field hockey team. They also took part at that time in many demonstrations against the German National Socialist Party, the Nazis. They came face to face with the so-called Brown Shirts, which were basically the Nazi paramilitary wing before they gained control and power in Germany. They apparently managed to avoid violent clashes at the time, though I'm sure things got pretty heated. And they stayed in Germany for 1 year before, in 1932, returning to England. Very good timing, because, of course, we know that Germany in the 30s saw the rise to power of the Nazis, and then, of course,
and then
war breaking out.
They were running.
In Europe.
They were looking for the communists and. They would have been rounded up.
Yeah, I mean, so very dramatic times.
Well, you can see already she's a cosmopolitan young lady because she lives in a house where it's British, but it has a lot of Russian connections.
Mm-hmm.
Father Latvian.
And this literary prestige as
of
well.
Of Tolstoy.
So
and Russia. There's always something there in the background. The fact that they were able to travel and live in other places shows that they were not afraid to just uproot and seeing the bigger world. So it all... adds up to someone who is curious and willing to take on a bigger cause.
And also we see her political activism, which was part of her parents as well. And specifically when she's in Germany, she's taking part in a political activism where at the time, I'm sure it was defined, even before they knew the full picture of the horrors that were to come, very much so about good versus evil. They saw the Nazis, rightfully so, as evil, and they were doing what they could to protest them. So standing up against injustices, if you're looking at a dossier of a person's profile and file, you would look at this person up till now and you say, okay, this person's got moxie. This person's got something.
All right, let's see what else she has.
No, you don't think so?
Let's see what else she has.
In England, in 1932, Melita, at 20 years old, she joined the Independent Labour Party and showed her leadership skills by becoming an organizer for the Association of Women Clerks and Secretaries. Most importantly, she also started working at that time as a clerk for the British Non-Ferrous Metals Research Association, the BNFMRA, where much of their work was of vital use for the defense industry and was linked to the British Atomic Weapons Program.
But not at the time.
Eventually, it would be linked to the atomic weapon program. Now, I want to put this again into context, right? We're leading up to conflict. The world, and especially England, because it's Europe, is seeing the rise of the Nazis, and they're building up to a potential conflict. Everyone's being put to work, and so she was no exception. Also, with the women's suffragette movement, you know, being active and working, we see her being part of the Women's Party.
Everybody's equal.
Everyone works as well.
From a Communist Party and background. So she wants to go out. She's not going to sit at home and just get married and have kids. That's not her lifestyle.
Right. Now, the fact that the BNFMRA later becomes involved in, well, it was involved with weapons, but later with the British Atomic Weapons Program is critical, as we will see in her career.
Correct. But I don't think that actually she went there to spy from the first place.
No.
I think she was lucky to get into that position, or she got that position. And it so happened it was a great position to be in.
Exactly.
I don't think she deliberately wanted to go to that position and thought that I'll be in that position and then anything I hear, I will report. I don't think that's the case. For what I saw and read, I didn't see anything to indicate that she was decided to go there for that reason.
I would agree with you wholeheartedly. I mean, she wasn't approached by any organization at that time either to do anything. But knowing her, like I know her through the research that's been done, I would simply say that she probably saw this as an opportunity to be involved in something that took the fight to the quote-unquote enemy more than becoming a secretary, let's say, in a post office. At the time, we do have to remember as well that the job opportunities were more limited for women, so being a secretary was kind of one of the main employment opportunities.
And she went to university, so she had a little bit more of a degree. And in those days, it was something.
Exactly. So why not do it at a more prestigious place that was involved with defense stuff to defend and fight against the Nazis, which was the main enemy at the time. 1935, Melita married Hilary Nussbaum, who later changed his name to Norwood. He was a chemistry teacher and a teacher's trade union official, as well as being a lifelong communist. Also, in 1935, Melita left the Independent Labour Party after the group splintered and secretly joined the Communist Party of Great Britain, the CPGB, becoming an active supporter of the party's newspaper, the Daily Worker. The Daily Worker, incidentally, was founded in 1930 and later renamed the Morning Star in 1966. And Melita continued to deliver this newspaper to her neighbors throughout her entire life. So
even after 1966?
Even when she was a 90-year-old? Yes, throughout her entire life, her neighbors would often say that, you know, they just thought she was an eccentric lady who would always deliver them this newspaper.
Well, it's not the newspaper. It was a communist newspaper.
Yeah, this particular newspaper.
Yes, it wasn't something just...
That's why she was eccentric to them,
yes,
among other things.
We'll see.
Now, why did her husband change her name? He was Jewish, and he changed his name to make it more anglicized. Of course, this was the rise of the Nazis, so he wanted to hide those things. And do you want to comment on that?
No, I don't know why. It was common for a lot of the Jewish people when they came to England or other European countries to try and change their name to become more local.
More anglicized.
And not bring with them the places they came from.
Yeah, but undoubtedly that experience also impacted her and influenced her. Melita's espionage career began in the mid-1930s when she became close friends with Andrew Rothstein, a friend of her mother's and a leading member of the CPGB, who recommended Melita to the NKVD, the forerunner to the KGB. Rothstein was an NKVD agent who became Melita's first handler. Now this is interesting, how everything connects. So through the friend literary circle, all these kind of things, she meets Rothstein, a member of the NKVD, connecting the circle. She also joined the Communist Party. Did she join it before she met her husband or after? Unclear the timing. Maybe they met even through the Communist Party. But all of these things are coming together at the same time as her being recruited.
I would like to mention about and talk about this thing a little bit. In this podcast, I would like to take both sides. One, the security service approach, and one, the Russian approach. What are we learning from the British security service approach? At this stage, you have someone who is known to be associated with Russian intelligence, the NKVD, who spots someone who thinks he could be useful, reports to his headquarters about it, to his superiors, and tells them there's someone here that they could use. Now, as we know, she was not caught, so we can then say that the British didn't have any information or they didn't have any sources that would give them information about that.
At the time. She was almost caught a couple times later.
Yes, but if you would have asked her handler, her first handler, is she an agent? He would have said yes. If who are your agents? Maybe he would try to avoid saying it. But she was an agent, but she was not exposed. So from that point of view, you would say the British was not able at that stage. That's a critical stage usually when the approach is made, being recruited. That's a very tricky situation. Both sides don't know where it's going to lead to. And at this situation, nothing happened to her from the British point of view. So she felt comfortable that the British are not aware of what she's doing because no one approached her or no one came to her, number one. Then look at it from the Russian point of view. The Russians felt comfortable because they got an information that they found reliable about someone who spotted someone could be useful to them. At the time, they were not aware maybe of the abilities that she can bring to them. But he, and this is again coming to some of the other podcasts we talked about, the ability of case officers or agents or intelligence agents to find assets that could be useful is very, very important. And he spotted her. She didn't approach. She didn't come and say, knocked on the door to an embassy or went to a party and looked at, went to the Russians and said, I want to work for you. She didn't volunteer. Someone came to her. So from the Russian point of view, they had this network, even though she was connected to the Russians or affiliated or had inspirations, she didn't actually try and do something at that stage. But the recruiter was easier because she liked or she felt comfortable working for someone who's connected to the Russians. Now, the British didn't approach her after she was recruited. Now, if she was recruited and someone spotted her and said something, if you had agents in the embassy or an agents running in who can tell you information, they would then come to her and say, listen, lady, we know you've been approached. Stop it. Work for us. Double agent or whatever. No one came to her. That means there was right. No, they didn't have anything. So I'm looking at that. That's from the British side. From the Russian side, they did an approach to someone. They didn't know as well if he's going to be working for them, be a double agent or not. But they had enough confidence in the spotter, you could say, her first handler.
Rothstein.
That, yeah. Yes, that he is bringing something that is good to the table. So that we're going to see how it goes along as the time goes by,
right.
How each one looked at it in a different way.
Right.
Okay? Yeah. So this is the situation with her. She's now working. And now, another interesting thing about it, she did not change her job. She is in the same job. She wasn't asked to change her job. She didn't. At the time, it wasn't clear how much information she knows. But she wasn't recruited and said, okay, now go and do something else. Go and change, do something. No. You're sitting in an interesting place. You could be a good asset for us. We would like to use you.
Right.
This is where it was at that stage.
Right. She was made a full agent in 1937, and we always have to remember the context of the time. In Russia, they were going through a bunch of changes. They had the revolution, they had different things, the communists came into power. Okay, so that happened.
Well, they came into power much earlier.
They came into power much earlier, but why was the father and the... Why were they kicked out before? Because they weren't. So things had changed since then, right?
Well, there was a change of leadership, different...
Right, exactly.
You know, Stalin came into power, Lenin wasn't around, they were supporters of Lenin. Of that generation,
but
Stalin
more,
changed a little right. bit, started to go after people he didn't like.
More importantly, British intelligence was not looking for Russian spies.
Correct. And that's the main thing to discuss.
Right. They weren't afraid of communists at the time.
No.
Okay. So Melina became a full agent in 1937 at 25 years old. She became a member of the Woolwich Spy Ring, a Soviet spy ring centered on a southeast London establishment on the south bank of the River Thames, which was used to manufacture armaments and ammunition, as well as doing proofing and explosives research for the British Armed Forces. So they really wanted to know about British armaments and different things there.
Well, they had supporters. They wanted to know everything.
Now, in January of 1938, the Woolwich spy ring was busted. Three leading members were arrested and sentenced to 3 to 6 years in prison. However, the MI5 failed to identify Melita and were unaware of Melita's secret party affiliations with the CPGB. When the Woolwich spy ring was busted, Melita was saved from detention by the fact that MI5 agents in charge also didn't believe that a young female secretary was capable of being a spy. So even though they weren't actively looking for communists, obviously because the Woolwich spy ring was directly doing things with this armaments and ammunitions area, that was a concern.
The fact is that they picked up people and they only sentenced them for a relatively short period in prison. Being a communist wasn't a crime, but spying and sending information is a crime. So there's two things here. And in this case, being a supporter of the Communist Party was not a crime. So from that point of view, she was a supporter of the Communist Party, but not necessarily a spy. So
they didn't know she was a member of the Communist Party, though. That was secret.
All right. Okay. I'll accept that.
And so it's also a little bit unclear if they knew that she was a member of the Woolwich spy ring and just saw that she was the secretary, like taking notes during it, or if they saw some association and saw that she was a secretary. And
well, if you look at it from in today's world, then if they picked up the ring and they caught the people, the interrogation or the questioning wasn't as good as it should have been because she managed to get off the hook. If they would have really had a go at these guys and really questioned them properly, maybe her name would have surfaced, but it didn't.
Right. Now, at the time, in the early 1930s, British spymaster Maxwell Knight was perhaps the only operative working in MI5 who believed that women made better spies than men. His most prolific agents that he recruited were all women, such as Mona Maud, who was the middle-class daughter of a retired officer, codenamed M2. Likely named after her handler, Maxwell Knight, known as M. Which, by the way, Knight is believed to be the inspiration for M in the James Bond movies. Now, Mona Maud's mission was to infiltrate the British Communist Party and pose as a typist. Mona was able to go unnoticed for the same reasons that Melita avoided detection. They were both seen as unlikely to be spies. Mona was actually the first to suspect that Melita was involved in espionage, noting her down as being suspicious as well as being a highly active member in the party, prone to long disappearances on occasion. Mona filed her report with Knight, who trusted her intuition, but when Knight briefed his superior, Jasper Harker, the report was ignored. Now, Harker was of the opinion that women could not make capable spies, and he concluded that Norwood was not worth investigating. The MI5 would only start to investigate Melita much later, even though that Knight pointed out that in the history of espionage, a high percentage of coups were conducted by women, but he was ignored. Where Knight was like an innovator and embracer of new perspectives, Harker was basically the polar opposite. Not a man that questions the status quo, and he was inflexible.
Old school.
Yes, he followed the accepted doctrines of the time. Spying was a male-centric job. He was only a director of MI5 for 1 year, between 1940 to 1941.
Okay, let's see what happens.
Ironically, another of Maxwell Knight's recruits, a woman, Olga Gray, was the one who busted the Woolwich spy ring. In Maxwell Knight's biography, M. Maxwell Knight, MI5's greatest spymaster, published in 2017, it says that had Mona Maud's intelligence on Melita been heeded, it would have changed the direction of the Cold War.
Interesting. Interesting. Not sure about that. But
perhaps
okay.
A bit of an overstatement, yes. But interesting nonetheless.
Okay.
He was an innovator. He hired all these spies. But she was close. She was close there. Beginning of her espionage career, maybe she wasn't so actively involved at the time then. You know, maybe she was in a lower position on the rung of the spy ladder and being more of a secretary and kind of tasting things out. But still, she was involved and she was missed.
Again, we have to remember, when you look at it on her job, she didn't change her job.
No, she was a secretary at this metals company.
And what changed is the nature of the position of the place she was working that made it more interesting.
So Melita's NKVD handlers advised her to go on ice after the spy ring bust. But she didn't have to wait long, only a few months, till May of 1938, before she resumed her duties as Agent Halle with a new Soviet handler. Recently immigrated agent Ursula Burton. A storied spy in her own right, she came to the UK posing as a German-Jewish refugee fleeing Nazi persecution. Ursula was codenamed Sonia and quickly established a new Soviet spy ring. In the early 1940s, all of the major powers started their atomic research programs. In 1941, despite the UK, the USA, and the USSR being allies on paper, the USSR had no reservations about spying on its allies in the atomic program, in order to get a head start in splitting the atom. By 1941, the Sonya spy ring included Melita amongst its ranks, as well as also the notorious double agent Klaus Fuchs, who was a German dissident scientist who publicly supported the British war effort, but later defected to the Soviets. Now, Fuchs is arguably one of the most important of the known atomic spies, due to his extensive access to high-level scientific data and ability to understand it through technical training, blah, blah, blah. But at the same time, it was Melita who was also providing data, because in her role as a secretary, she had access to her boss's safe and papers and documents, which, slowly, slowly, she was filtering to the Soviets. But it was also during this time that a wave of purges were happening in Moscow, which led the NKVD to cut back on overseas espionage, gradually reorganizing, eventually becoming the KGB, later towards 1953. Winding back, 1942, however, Melita's primary handlers would become the GRU. A lot of different acronyms, but things were shifting in the Soviet world.
Yes, they were.
It was a newly created Foreign Intelligence Service for the Soviet Union. 1943, during the height of World War II, Melita began working as the secretary to G.L. Bailey. Same job, just a new person. More importantly, he was a member of the advisory committee to the Tube Alloys Program, which was the code name for the UK's atomic weapons program. Melita suddenly being one of the most importantly positioned Soviet spies, seeing as her boss was working on the bomb. Melita would sneak into his office, open the safe, and take pictures of the classified documents with a sub-miniature camera provided by her handlers. Likely the Minox sub-miniature camera, infamous as the most widely used spy camera at the time. Melita would then arrange a meeting to hand the camera back to her handlers, ensuring that she never had any confidential materials or incriminating evidence for very long. Clever, because sometimes we've seen people wanting to photocopy and then return and all this kind of stuff. No, just give the camera directly there. Probably the same day she even did the thing, so it really wouldn't be on her for very long. Thoughts so far?
Well, again, you have to look at it from both sides. The British were not interested so much in the Russians at the time, or maybe they were, but if they were, they should have done a better job. And they were aware that the Russians are looking at them.
But not important. But limited resources.
But they didn't look at her. And that means that they didn't have any sources that will tell them in the embassy or anywhere else that they're running someone so important like her. From the Russian point of view, they were very clever, and they are. And they said, okay, stay on, you know, we're playing the long game. No need to you to rush into anything. Stay where you are. It's an interesting position. Don't try and make any waves. See what comes your way. It's interesting. And then all of a sudden, bonanza. The new guy has access to fantastic material. Now, the fact that he is able, that he has this material is acceptable. The fact that his secretary can go in and out of the safe, that is not so good. He was not aware of it, and I'm sure no one else was aware of it. Now, if you look at it, we're going to get to it later. I mean, why wasn't she called before? But just to say, look at this from a different perspective. When did she start working?
She started working
in that office.
In 1932, I think it was.
Now, she started to work before the Second World War, and she's like already 10 years. She's a 10-year veteran in the office. She's like an establishment. Everybody trusts her. No one questions her. She's like a pillar of knowledge. People rely on her, and she's not looking to do promotion. She's not interested to do anything dramatic. And most important, there was no vetting. So no one actually ever wanted to check on her to see what she's up to.
Why bother? Why need?
Why need?
Once you're already in somewhere, it's harder to check someone.
Well, when this guy came into position, in today's world, he would have gone through vetting and his documents would have been secured, or anyone who touches the documents would have been vetted. But that wasn't the case at the time.
I'm going to challenge you here, okay? In today's world, if you're working in an organization that handles secret information, okay?
Yes.
And someone has already been working there for X amount of years, almost 10 years, and she's assigned to you, you assume that she's already been vetted. Just because she's now working for you as a secretary doesn't necessarily mean that you would go through another round of vetting.
If
it's
you
the
are
same organization.
If you're working for an industry that deals with secrets, there's always someone that's responsible for security.
Right.
And safety. Or safety and security, or keeping the material secret. That person would know if someone needs to be vetted or not, or had a second look at him. Especially when she was not hiding the fact that she was a communist, okay? She didn't openly say so, but She was delivering communist papers every morning, okay? It wasn't so difficult to find out.
That's the funny thing. It wasn't hard to find out.
Yeah, so...
But you can deliver communist papers without being a member of the Communist Party.
No, okay.
And they didn't know she was a member of the Communist Party,
No one looked at her. That was the thing. No one looked at her.
She was a spy you never saw.
Exactly. No one looked at her. And not only that... there was no need to at that stage.
Right, because the Russians weren't the enemy. Everyone was focused on defeating
the German Nazis.
Right. Now, just we did three episodes on Juan Pujol. This is the same time period as Juan Pujol.
Yes.
MI5, same organization.
Yes.
They're all of their resources and manpower are doing things like that.
Yes.
You know, you're going to worry about this.
Maybe even a nuclear that's maybe in the planning. You know, it's really far, far away from the mainstream as it is today.
Right. It's interesting how the British were so effective in stopping Nazi spies because that was what their focus was, but the Russian infiltration was far more...
Because it wasn't on the focus at the time.
Yeah. I mean, the Cambridge Five was also the same time, so it's... Well, I guess the Russians were always clever in their recruiting and the way they ran things.
Let's see what happens.
In 1945, Melita shared documents to the GRU described as... being of great interest and of value contribution to the development of work in this field. KGB recording that Melita was a committed, reliable, and disciplined agent, striving to be of the utmost assistance. The information she supplied on the behavior of uranium at high temperatures permitted the Soviet Union to test their atomic bomb 4 years earlier than the UK and US intelligence services thought possible. So they say, anyway.
I couldn't believe that, because basically what you're looking for, especially at GRU, was to shortcut your time that you have to spend on research.
Absolutely.
And if someone else does the research for you and you get all the information, you have it in front of you, you don't have to go through all the obstacles that they did. So you shorten the time, saves manpower, saves energy, saves resources.
And this is what all of Vladimir Vetrov's stuff was
about. Exactly. Yes.
About the intelligence industry.
That's why how important it is.
Yeah. Save a lot of time and money. Save yourself 4 years. That's huge.
Yes.
A lot of money.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
As World War II ended and things morphed into the Cold War, the MI5 became increasingly aware and suspicious of suspected enemy agents from the Soviet bloc. Twice in 1947, British counterintelligence questioned Ursula Burton, the Sonya spy ring's leader. On both occasions, they felt they didn't have enough hard evidence to do anything. However, Ursula, knowing it was only a matter of time before she was exposed, escaped to East Germany. Her star agent, Klaus Fuchs, was less lucky or less skilled and was arrested in 1950. Now, this is a big shift because when World War II ended and the Cold War began, the whole intelligence situation
It shifted. There
changed.
Was a new enemy. There was a new... Look, intelligence organizations need a target. They need something to do.
Right.
And Nazis is over. Okay, what do we do now, guys?
Who's the next enemy we need to take care of? But also... going back to season one, we have someone like Gozenko in Canada who reveals the extent of the Soviet infiltration, specifically in the nuclear field, just in general.
Even before the West even knew they had to worry about it.
Exactly. And so suddenly, not only did they realize, first of all, they needed a new target, but more than that, they realized that their new target was way ahead of them.
Correct.
So they had to catch up.
Yes.
And they had to...
And that's why Ursula had to leave. Yeah. Because she had assets that they didn't want her exposed.
So, for instance, she was questioned twice, but they didn't have enough hard evidence to do anything about it. That's a failure of intelligence, I would say. Why are you questioning her twice before you can actually do anything about it? And we've talked about the idea of sitting on intelligence before. Why would they act? What would they have to gain on sitting on her then?
Well,
trying to get a confession?
Well, no, I would look at it in a different way. They know she's up to something. They know they don't have maybe the resources to find it out, but maybe it's better to remove her from the arena and by giving her...
So they wanted her gone.
Yeah.
Showing that they were onto her, but they didn't know exactly what.
They said, okay, let's disrupt whatever she's doing, let's disrupt it. We know she's up to no good. We have... It's more difficult for us to find out who she's in touch with or what's going on for different reasons. We don't know. But by talking to her, they're giving her enough information to, for her to feed back to her, to her superiors, that maybe it's time for you to leave. It's too dangerous for you. It's okay. It's okay. It's a tactic. It doesn't mean that you wanted to arrest her. And as well, you have to remember, if they arrested her, do they have to then maybe know, say what they know and how they know things? Maybe they have assets that they didn't want to reveal. We don't know that. If they would have known that she was an asset, such an important asset, and giving information, they would have done something about it. So I don't think they had huge assets. But maybe Ursula's name came up from the Canadians, through the Canadian connection. And they're saying, oh, her networks. And they started to look at it because they didn't know anything. And then they went to her because they had to. And then they warned her, listen, we know about you.
I mean, the farewell dossier, Vetrov also provided information.
Yeah. And then they decided, So
that was later.
So they left. So she left. And then they say, okay, who's going to be next? Then it's easier to find out who replaces her.
Also, it's interesting. Maybe they used it to smoke them out. You know, if they put pressure and then you see who else runs.
Yes.
And if other people are running, then...
Well, if they're running, that means they're no longer around. If they're no longer around, they're not so much of a threat.
Right. Well, as the Soviet spy ring melted around her faster than a snowman in July, Melita received orders to go on ice for a second time. By 1951, however, she resumed her espionage activities with additional Cold War precautions.
So when did Ursula leave? What year?
She was twice questioned in 1947, and then she left, and then Klaus Fuchs was arrested in 1950. I'm not sure exactly when Ursula left.
So she was, they put her on ice for some years.
Maybe some years.
Clever.
Less amount of time, 1 year. Yeah. Most amount of time, 4 years.
That's, again, long time thinking.
Right. Soviets are very good at that.
Yes.
They were very good at
the
long-term...
The long game.
The long game.
Yes.
Yes. They don't have to give as many receipts or easier for them to justify their receipts?
They gave receipts, but it took a long time to get to the headquarters.
However, as I said, by 1951, Melita was back in business with additional Cold War precautions. On the surface, she would live a quiet, uneventful family suburban life. But beneath this, there would be a different story. Melita was incredibly adept at stealing, acquiring, or copying sensitive scientific material and getting that information into the hands of the GRU agents who she was working with. She always maintained a low profile, limiting her deliveries to 4 or 5 times a year, normally handoffs in the suburbs of Southeast London, through the favored method of a dead drop or a swipe.
Now that's very clever.
Four or five times a year. Compare that to Vetrov, who we talked about earlier this season, who so much information so fast and was hard to process and also very dangerous. Less exposure, less threat.
Now if you think about it as well, look, what kind of information she would have? The information is not something that comes in every day. There's some new information.
Right. Scientific developments.
Scientific developments, research programs.
This is already
programs.
Post-atomic.
It's post-atomic, okay. But still, how much... new stuff that makes you need to have a meeting once a week or once a month.
Yeah.
Not that much.
Not that much.
It's not necessary. But anytime there's needed an update or there's something new, she was able to bring this information. The information was things that she heard, not so much, more things that she read or took from the boss.
I don't even know if she read the stuff too much because it was about being fast and undetected. So... you know,
well,
take
she
a picture,
took a picture,
take a picture, take
she
a picture,
maybe
leave.
Know, yes, but...
Because she also doesn't understand,
well,
necessarily.
Correct, but she knows if it's top secret or
right,
secret.
She knows if it's seemingly
and she has
important.
To file it or type something or respond to it because mm-hmm. that's what she had to do because she was the loyal secretary.
Right.
So she would know all about it, so she had it. Now, 4 or 5 times a year, I don't know how many years she did that, but
Many years.
That's perfect because the places she chose were something that would make sense. Dead letter boxes or means of places where she wasn't. She could drop it off and someone would take it. Not necessarily have physical.
So explain the dead drop and the swipe.
Well, dead letter box is a place that you can decide that that's agreed on both sides that you drop something off, someone else picks it up. There's no physical contact between the people.
Okay, let's say a mailbox, a P.O. box somewhere.
No.
No?
Not necessarily. It could be a park, could be something in a bench, some hole in a bench or
I see.
Something, a tree that's hollow with or something. It could be all sorts of places that...
But it wouldn't normal. Be something like a post box.
It could be, but then you have a
too
key.
Many
you,
eyes.
You have a key. Why do you want a key? It connects you. I mean,
right.
Would you want something that doesn't connect you to the other person.
Okay.
And if there's, I mean, if it's a P.O. box, then if someone knows about it, someone could surveillance on the P.O. box, then you see it, and then you see what it's all about. Mm-hmm. Now, the swipe, if I understand what they mean, is that, you know, one person has a briefcase, another has a briefcase, and as you saw in the films, they pass it to each other, or they pass it by physically seeing each other and then having a quick switch. You don't see her having so much contact with her agent, with her handler.
Right.
In this case. That's another thing that protected her. And another thing that protected her...
She's in the suburbs.
No, the suburbs is not the main thing.
Well, I want to ask you about the suburbs.
Okay. The main other thing is that she never took money.
Well, we're going to get to that too.
Okay. And so there was no money transfer. She didn't need the money.
Right.
There wasn't any
again,
money.
Ideology, which we talked about.
We'll talk about that later as well. But so there was no need for her, like, okay, where's the money? You know, There's a money bag going from one side to another.
It's a lot easier when there's no money involved.
Right. The expenses. She didn't ask for any expenses. I have a,
she was already working there.
She didn't have to give her receipts, you know, for the taxes or for the tube or anything else.
Well, she had them come to her neighborhood.
She came to the neighborhood. Yeah. You know, she wasn't going somewhere that unusual. Let's say she was going to watch a match somewhere and sitting on a bench watching a tennis match in Richmond or Twickenham, you know, somewhere in the south where it's normal for her to come and someone will sit next to her and pick up something. It's okay. It's normal.
Yeah.
She doesn't do it every week. Of course, the person that does it is supposed to take precautions and is not seen, and she's taking precautions. Did she get any training? I don't think she got any training, but...
Yeah, there's no evidence to suggest that she got any formal spy training, likely on the job
training.
And
she never traveled outside. You never have any information of her traveling to meet her handlers.
No.
Now, maybe, we don't know that, maybe over the years, she did go from time to time on holiday with her husband and daughter, or with her husband, let's say, to certain places around the world, and then she met her handler there,
maybe.
Not in England.
But also, remember, she was a member of the Communist Party.
Yes.
And so there would probably be meetings, Communist Party meetings.
That's where you don't want to do anything. At those years, if you're a spy, you don't want to go to these meetings because you bring the suspicion on you.
Right.
So that's not the place you want to meet because other people can report on you and things. This is not a good place to go. And not a place
also,
good
there's
meet.
Also the newspaper. So maybe there's messages in the newspaper that we don't know about.
I think it's
She was too important
to them to leave it to some amateur guy or some mistake. And that's why she was never caught.
Why do you think she was so important?
Because the things she saw, they couldn't have got from anywhere else. And it was time consuming as well because, you know, she wasn't getting younger anymore. And at a certain point, probably the information was not, I mean, we don't know how many years this gentleman was in this position, but obviously... If anyone who took his position was in the committee, then it doesn't make any difference. But then she wasn't moved to in a different position.
Well, as well as you said, you know, once you are in the same job for so many years, you know, she's the veteran. She's been here. She knows all the secrets.
And it's not
all
like
the corridors,
today that people want to move up. And I'm 3 years in my job. Why don't I get a promotion? I want to move up to become something else. She was very happy to do what she did, And ideologically, she felt that she was in the right place in the right time for her to be. So why move? But I like the fact that, you see, again, I like the fact that the Russians knew to play the long game and not push and understand, you know, we don't need a meeting every week. We don't need every month. We do it when we need to. On the other hand, the Brits had no idea that she was doing anything behind their nose.
Well, you say that, but in 1965, the MI5 were once again close to arresting Melita. They finally concluded that Melita had been spying for the Soviets since the 1930s, but... she wasn't detained or interviewed. Why? because the intelligence officers wanted to hide how much they knew about her activities to protect their other investigations, allowing her to continue handing secrets to the Soviets. Because once again, we know about her. She's a secretary. Big deal. Undervaluing her role. And to be fair, it was already 1965. Wasn't like the nuclear program was being handled in that office anymore. So the secrets that she was passing on were admittedly less high value, though still valuable.
So she was already in 50s.
She was 53 at the time.
Okay.
We've talked about sitting on information before. So you have this spy that you know has been spying on you since the 1930s. Why don't you act? Protect your other investigations? What other investigations?
Because maybe, as we know as well in the history, that they had other bigger fish they wanted to catch that were working for the Russians.
And so the Russians would have been spooked if one of their people was caught?
It means that the British had an understanding of what was going on, and they will start doing investigations. And as you mentioned when you read it earlier, when you were talking about it earlier, they wanted to protect other assets that they had. Now, what does it mean, other assets? That means that if you reveal that you know her, then the Russians will start, and you investigate and you bring her in for questioning, then obviously they'll say, okay, where's the leak? Where's the leak coming from? It can only come from two places, or from London or from Russia. Right. Now, if they have someone in Russia, would it's worth the risk? No. If it's someone in London and is giving them information about what's going on and is giving them information about current activity of the Russians and not of someone who worked 30 years already and, okay, she's not in the House of Parliament, she's not in the military, she's not a... So, okay, all right. So
she's a secretary at some metals company. Okay.
She worked for the Communist Party. She's a communist. All right. What does she know already? All right. Okay. Let's put an eye on her, but let's not make any waves. Mm-hmm. It makes sense. Makes sense.
Mm-hmm. In the mid-1960s, Melita, however, graduated from recruited to recruiter, enlisting the services of a civil servant codenamed Hunt. Agent Hunt and Halla, passing extensive scientific and technical intelligence on British armaments and arms sales to the KGB and GRU. So this is the kind of information that they were passing at this point. Interesting that she was recruiting now as well.
She felt comfortable enough to do it, and that's interesting, because what does it mean that she recruited someone? That means someone gives her the information and then she gives it onwards, or she recruited it and gave someone else to handle.
Yeah.
Not clear here.
No, I mean, it's pretty clear that she passed the information on to the handler.
But if she recruited, that means she spotted someone.
Yeah, much like Rothstein did with her.
Yes, I mean, she noticed someone that is maybe sympathetic to the cause.
Right.
And she told her handlers, listen, I think this is someone you should approach. I don't think she personally approached a person and asked them to work for them, unless she was supposed to be the one that gets information. Now, that puts in a different category of spy master. That means that she's already running agents. She's already running them. I don't think that was the role. So she spotted people and delivered them to the Russians, and the Russians then ran them. If I was the Russians, that's what I would have wanted her to do. She's too valuable for them.
Keep the low profile.
To keep a low profile.
Well, in 1958, before she was recruiting, she was awarded the Order of the Red Banner by the KGB. And in 1960, she was offered a monthly salary of £20. Today, equivalent to about £388, plus or minus £4,656 a year. Comparatively a low amount, especially considering other documented Soviet double agents at the time. Some offered five times as much, but Melita was never interested in the money, and she refused the salary, obviously much to the benefit of her secrecy. She later said to the BBC after her exposure, "I did what I did, not to make money, but to help prevent the defeat of a new system which had, at great cost, given ordinary people food and fares which they could afford, a good education, and a health service. I thought, perhaps, what I had access to might be useful in helping Russia to keep abreast of Britain, America, and Germany. In general, I do not agree with spying against one's country." It's harder to catch without money being passed along.
Not necessarily, but in this case, it's easier to run an agent because you don't have to. His loyalty is to you. And the loyalty is a lot of it is in words. You can buy it by words. You're doing good for the motherland. You're doing good for the cause. These are the things they want to hear. We're giving you a medal of honor for what you're doing.
Exactly.
You don't need more than that. I mean, you're not to say, I want to, you don't have a meeting. Okay, I want 500 for this and I want 800. No, you start bargaining about it.
Of course, she also never went to Russia.
As far as we know, she didn't, and she shouldn't have, and probably she never did.
No, but what I'm saying is, so all of the stories that she said, all of her quotes about, you know, bringing food and fares and education and health service.
I mean, that's, I won't say it's
that's
naive.
That's the fantasy.
It's the time.
That it's
was
what they're putting in the newspaper.
Ideologically, she felt that this is what she grew up on it. She, from childhood, she grew up on the idealism of communism. Mm-hmm. The idealism of communism that she grew up with was not in Russia anymore. But never mind, it was in her mind.
Yeah.
And
she
believed
in
it.
And those newspapers she was distributing every day.
Of course.
Every week.
And they believed it.
Yeah. Yeah. So you're saying it's not harder to catch someone if there's no money involved?
That it's not harder?
Yeah. I would say it's harder because it's one less component that you can follow.
I am
follow.
Saying it's harder to catch someone, yes. It's not a matter of catching. There's one less thing that you have to worry about.
Exactly.
Because money smells.
Money, mo problem.
It leaves a trail.
Interestingly, in 1958, Melita joined the campaign for nuclear disarmament and became a lifelong advocate.
She believed in it.
Yeah. Look, she was an idealist. That's very apparent in everything in her life, that she was a big idealist.
Yes. And she didn't see contradiction in both of them.
Nope. Not at all.
Let everybody have it, and therefore no one will use it.
Nor did she see contradiction in what she said, that she does not agree with spying against one's country, but felt that she wasn't spying against the country because it was
she believed
simply leveling the playing field.
For her, she thought that by doing that, I don't want to go into what she thought, but I can assume that she believed that if everybody has the same information, that one deters the other, and therefore you maintain peace.
And she believed that the Soviet Union was a glorious place that she wanted to help as well.
Exactly.
Doing good.
Yes.
1973, after 30-odd years of service, Melita, at 61, decided to retire both from her work at the BNFMRA and her covert work. To some, she was a spy that was considered as the most important female agent in KGB history. She was also the longest serving of all spies in Britain, and at that point, was also a retired grandmother.
Great. I mean, how many nice stories you have about people retiring without being caught and doing their work and managing to do what she had to do.
I think it's a bit of a stretch to say that she was the most important female agent in KGB history, though.
She had I would say she was working in the most interesting times to be a spy in the era where things were happening, where alliances were shifting.
Yes.
And she was able to stay under the surface without being found out. And probably she had so many handlers that probably the last handler that handled her was born after she was born.
Probably. But that doesn't make her the most important. Really, bottom line is the information she brought, by and large, the largest thing was speeding up the nuclear process by 4 years. If you can attribute that solely to her, okay. You could attribute it to also other sources, yes.
I mean, I just correct myself, not born after she was born, but when he was born, she was already working as an agent.
Yeah. But, you know, I just think it's a little bit of an exaggeration. I'm not saying that she didn't do very interesting things and that she was very successful in what she did, but, I mean, they had a lot of important spies.
They did.
But how did people find out that she was a spy? Well, November 1992, former Soviet operative and archivist Vasily Mitroshin defected to the West, bringing thousands of documents smuggled from the KGB. After finally going over the information with and debriefing Western allies, the MI6 allowed its publication. Late in 1995, Mitroshin was introduced to an official historian of the MI5, Christopher Andrew, and together they worked till 1999 compiling the information before publishing the Mitroshin Archive. The year before, in 1998, the British Home Secretary, Jack Straw, was informed for the first time of Melita Norwood's role, and he consulted the security services and the attorney general on whether to prosecute. In April of 1999, a decision was reached. No action would be taken against Agent Halla due to her age and that 26 years had passed since her retirement as a spy. They also considered the consequences of a public trial, exposing the embarrassing past failures of MI5. The whole time, Melita was unaware of the debate surrounding her. And then finally, in September of 1999, the papers were published, her name leaking. And at that same time, Melita had developed a friendship with the author David Burke, who was a Russian literature scholar. Burke regularly traveling from Leeds to London to sit with Melita to interview her about her father's work with Tolstoy. Usually they would have Sunday lunch together. Melita serving him tea in Che Guevara mugs. How quaint.
Lovely.
Lovely. On the 11th of September, 1999, heading to Melita's home, Burke noticed an article in the Times featuring a preview of the Matroshin archive, exposing Melita as the spy who had betrayed British scientific secrets to the Soviet Union for 40 years. Burke immediately phoned Melita, asking if they could still meet. Melita replying, "You'd better come next week. The world's press has found its way to my doorstep. You see, I have been a rather naughty girl." Melita turned down all offers from newspapers to buy her story, instead preferring to tell her story for free to her friend David Burke. When they sat, Burke claimed her mannerism suggested nothing particularly interesting had happened in recent days, once more serving tea in those Che Guevara mugs, as he himself, in a state of shock, jotted down notes and let her talk as she told her story. Melita shared that her husband, who had died in 1986, had known about her activities, you know, and all of her espionage. He disapproved of it, but never tried to stop her. Their only daughter, however, was just as surprised as everyone else about her mother's double life. I don't know. Do you think children should be surprised about discovering things about their parents?
I think sometimes it's better the children don't know what their parents do.
You think so?
It makes it much easier for the parents to continue the job.
Yeah.
Don't you think so, Omri?
I don't know. I guess sometimes kids ask their parents all sorts of silly questions and things after they find out, right?
Yes, but it's okay.
It's okay?
You think so? Sometimes. But in this case, on the serious note, I think having her husband on her side made it easy for her. The fact that he didn't betray her shows the commitment they had to each other and that he was as well a loyal communist because he wasn't against, he couldn't have lived with her if he wasn't a communist in his heart.
Sure.
And we know he was, and he was a socialist. So from his point of view, it was okay. It wasn't something that he couldn't live with. From the daughter's point of view, okay, what did she do? She went out to meetings in the middle of the night. She went out doing things. She lived a very normal life.
Yeah.
She didn't do anything.
Four or five times a year, she went to the park.
Went to the park, and then maybe in the afternoon or whatever, or in the morning before. Yeah. There was nothing. She didn't do anything dramatic. I mean, what did your mother do? She worked in a government office for 40 years, finished with a pension, had a handshake, got the money, and off she went. What I liked about the ending as well is that she sold her story for nothing. That she could have said, you know what, for all the time that I worked, this is the time I could make some money on the book, and she would have been a bestseller, and she would have made a lot of money. But she didn't even want to take any money for it.
Yeah.
Now, because she was idolatry.
Yeah.
Now, she could have said, you know what, I'll take the money and I'll donate it, or I'll do something. But it shows the commitment that from her point of view, it was 100% commitment to the cause, and she was happy to do it. She didn't feel... And she said, yes, I was a naughty girl. I like that. I was a naughty girl. I did something naughty, but it was the British...
Terribly British,
very,
yes.
Terribly British. So she was British, but she was British with ideology of the communists, the old communists as they used to be in the old days, where they were really, really committed to the cause.
No, and she believed it.
Yes. Again, if you look, how was she discovered? Not because of MI5 were able to find out through their sources.
Well, I mean, they did discover earlier, but...
Yes, but...
She was exposed finally
because someone actually came and put it in their face. Look, she was a Russian asset and she had good information. So they had to do something about it.
Right.
Now, the Minister of, Interior, Jack Straw, in the end, had to make a decision. So you prosecute an 80-year-old woman. What do you want to do? You're going to put her in prison for 10 years, 5 years, and you expose what? And then you have to bring all the old people up. And then, you know what? Sometimes you lose, sometimes you win. She got away. Good luck to her.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
The thing is, do they know how much information she gave? And that, I think they will never know.
On June 2nd, 2005, Melita passed away at New Cross Hospital in Wolverhampton. She was 93. Some intelligence analysts have questioned how effective and important Melita was, some arguing that Soviet research may have already possessed the so-called secrets that she delivered. Matryoshkin's papers, however, acknowledge that Agent Hala was held in high esteem by Moscow. So much so that the KGB and the GRU apparently frequently argued on who should handle her. Agency infighting, huh?
Always. Because it's important.
Why is it important to fight?
No, it's important because each one brings a different attitude and a different way of handling it. You know, the GRU were looking at maybe the long run. They were, it's more technical, maybe less penetrated. KGB maybe more ruthless, more brutal, but then maybe more in the eyes of the British.
Right.
And every operative who's going to run around trying to recruit someone or be in contact with someone had more chances that he would be exposed. So it's not just rivalry who will recruit her, who will run her, but how to do it the best way.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, I think it was the right thing. Whoever ran her well. Give them credit when the credit is deserved.
And if you want to hear how you don't run an agent, listen to the farewell episode.
As you could say so, yes.
It's said that the KGB even considered Melita to be more valuable than the famous Cambridge Five, the British double agents, who from Western point of view were regarded as some of the most dangerous double agents in espionage history. Yet it's said that the KGB placed Melita's value over them. Matryoshkin's files even showing that the Cambridge Five were seen by handlers as hopeless drunks incapable of keeping secrets. Now, when the Soviets see you as hopeless drunks, you know it's got to be bad, right?
Yes, and there's something else here that you could say about her. Having her not caught is part of the myth, and you could say that this is one of the nice things about it. The Cambridge Five, as they want to call them, or other ones that got caught because something went wrong. But
right.
when someone gets away and manages to stay for that long undetected, you feel proud as an organization that you're able to do it. And I think it showed them that they can have success even in the UK for so long. And that, for them, was a success.
Right.
More than the actual intelligence that she brought.
Yeah. Unfortunately, the greatest spy in history we'll never get to do an episode on because we'll never know they were.
And you're talking about?
I don't know. Because we'll never know they were a spy.
I don't know what you're talking about.
I'm just saying in general that, like...
Yes, but who knows who was a spy because there's never no one who was a spy.
But the best spies are the ones that, you know, we would never know and we'll never know and we'll never know their life story. You know?
Right.
You, for instance.
No.
If you were caught and something bad happened, you know, your story would be out there. We'd know at least the operation in which you were caught on. Thankfully, that never happened, you know, so you're a great spy. You managed to survive. No comment?
No comment.
Why would Melita be considered a superstar spy?
Because she knew what she wanted. She knew not to go to get to places she couldn't get. She positioned herself in the right place in the right time, and she didn't try and push herself to do more things than she needed to. And she kept very humble.
Mm-hmm. And she didn't take money.
And one sort of thing, she didn't take money, but that's part of being humble.
Right.
But the thing is, when you have someone 30 years in the same job doing the same thing, you don't expect her to be a spy, unless it's a very important position. If you're the chief of army, you know, okay, thank you very much. But a secretary working for a metal company, you didn't think that would be the most important thing. She got lucky. I mean, she could have had that job and nothing would have come through that safe and nothing would have come through to the manager.
Mm-hmm.
And it would have been just selling aluminium and metals. And it's interesting, but not anything to do with nuclear.
Right.
Nuclear obviously became very, very important to everybody afterwards. And she just found herself in the right place in the right time. The genius thing about it was the Russians, the way they realized that she was a gem and play the long game with her and keep her away from networks as much as they could, and the handling was probably done in a professional way that she was not detected.
Also, you have to attribute part of her success for British intelligence ineptitude.
In what way?
They didn't identify her. They had opportunities. There were suspicions all the way back when the Woolwich spy ring was busted. There was suspicions then,
yes, but
you could have kept an eye on her then.
But they didn't.
Exactly. So part of her success is also the failure of British intelligence to act on intelligence that they had.
The failure is a strong word, is the idea of the British internal security, MI5, that this is something that's worthwhile investigating and looking into. And there are a number of they had opportunities to get understand more. Once they decided not to because they didn't do the good investigative job. The second time with Orsella, when she left, they had maybe an opportunity, but they decided to let her go. They didn't want to have the sources, as we said, they had compromised. Yeah. And maybe in early 60s, again, maybe they had another opportunity and they decided just to skip it. It's not worth it. So they had information. But again, if you look back in today's world, a person like that could not have made it in today's world because of the vetting. There's no way a person like that could be in a position that has opportunity to look at classified information with that kind of background. She wasn't hiding her background as a communist.
Are you talking about the background of her being a member of the Communist Party? Because that theoretically could have been hid, or the background of her familial
but
ties.
But she didn't. Anyone who would do a vetting would find out all about her, and she wouldn't have been allowed to do those jobs.
Okay, but let's say she wasn't a member of the Communist Party, right?
She wouldn't have been doing that job if they would have done a proper vetting.
Okay, but again, let's
say... Even if she didn't belong to the Communist Party.
Okay, so by a mere fact of seeing that she was delivering this newspaper, that her parents were involved with these circles, that her father was this, that she met with that guy, that kind of stuff would be enough through the vetting.
Yes, if you think, if your Russia is your... It's like... The jihadist, okay, in today's world. Would you employ someone who goes to the mosque where you know there's the imam there is preaching for jihad and people making suicide? Will you put him in a ammunition factory? No.
Right. I want to talk about quiet espionage versus loud operations. The difference between intelligence gathering and what we'll call quiet espionage and loud espionage, which is like doing operations, doing things.
No, that's not loud. If you do things, you want to keep it quiet.
But sometimes you want to send a message, right?
You prefer to send it quietly.
Okay. Is there an advantage? So everything is always better quiet, is what you're saying.
Yes. Unless it has a political reason, you want to make something very, very, expose something. But even then, I believe better to keep what we do quiet, because there was a price to pay for exposure.
So let's take a more extreme type of example. Let's say an assassination. An organization decides that something or someone needs to be assassinated for whatever reason, and they can do it quietly, or they can blow up the car in the middle of broad daylight.
Well, we did an episode about the Russian guy who his plane just came off the air, right?
Yes, of course. Yeah, Prigozhin.
Prigozhin, yes, you remember? So there was assassination. It was a loud assassination. Putin wanted to send a message. He didn't want to say that he did it, but everybody knew he did it. Was there an investigation afterwards? No. Did anybody cry after about it? No. Even now when the opposition leader now...
Alexei Navalny, yeah.
Is no longer with us. He decided to get rid of him. He got rid of him. Now that's internal. And when you do it external... We can talk about maybe the North Korean leader, but we can maybe have a special podcast on that, how he got rid of enemies that he didn't like. But countries do that as well, if sometimes necessary. The Saudis did it in Turkey. Was it good for them? You would call that a loud and a message. Is that good? No. In the end, it's no good. Espionage people prefer to do things quietly. And the people who know about it, they know about it. It doesn't have to go out in the
news. Need to know basis.
They realize, okay.
Okay. Well, as we're getting along in this episode, I think we should wrap it up. Anything else you want to say?
I think it's interesting how we have a success from the Russian side. We've always had podcasts on success of the Western side, you could say, in some ways. Mm-hmm. And here you had a success on the Russian side, and how important the tradecraft is. How important is to run an agent is an art, and understanding how to run an agent is very, very important in our game, in our profession. On the other hand, as a security service, how easy it sometimes you can miss something by just having a conception that you think is right, and then all of a sudden you find out it's not right. Okay, in those days maybe it was different, but there are tools that help you to do your job. If you don't do them, you pay a price.
Having a false conception on something leads to bad mornings when the world wakes up and you realize your whole worldview is wrong.
Correct.
We will end with a Zen Buddhist proverb. The quieter you become, the more you are able to hear. Melita's story teaches us to never underestimate the ability of an individual, no matter how ordinary and unassuming they appear. David Burke would write that Melita would often shake her head and repeat, "I thought I'd got away with it. I thought I'd got away with it." The truth of the matter was, she had. This was Spies and Lies. Thanks for listening, and remember,
if you see an old woman, she might have been an old spy.
Or a young spy.
You never know.
Spies and Lies is a Grumpy Golem production, with original scoring and mastering by Julian Dussault. If you enjoyed listening, don't forget to share with your friends and leave a comment or review wherever you listen from. It really does help. And if you want, you can check out our Facebook page and write us there. If you have any questions or subjects you'd like for my father and I to cover, drop us a message and we'll do our best to get back to you. Special thanks to Julian Dobrev, who conducted research for the episode. Until next time.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.